I'd now ask that you give our brother Don your careful and your prayerful attention.
Good morning to you each. Glad to see you all here. And even people I didn't expect to see. This morning, in our Sunday school class, I presented the thought that the word marred comes from a Greek word that means battered. And so, you know, you're going to get another battering. I'm sorry about that. I would like to bring to you a lesson today about a different kind of subject than I ordinarily preach about. But I feel like in some senses it's a very timely and important thing because of the great amount of deception that is abroad on the face of the earth today. And the subject is going to be the abomination of desolation. And not a simple subject. You know, and I only approach it because of what Brother Jim said when he preached last week, that some of us are capable of taking strong meat. We just don't need milk. So this is one of those sort of strong meat kind of sermons, lessons today. But I would like to study with you today a good share of chapter 8 in the book of Daniel. The prophet Daniel lived in a very difficult time of Jewish history when they were in captivity in Babylon. And in four of his prophecies, he mentions this abomination of desolation. But I'm only going to talk about one of them, and that's chapter 8. This is sort of chapter 1 in the subject of the abomination of desolation. And I want you to remember, you know, that this poor young man had been a captive, longing for Jerusalem, the holy city, the temple where he had worshipped as a child, dreaming about it, longing for it. And yet he'd spent most of his life in captivity. He's an old man when he received this vision, this revelation. But through his life he has been prayerful. He's been praying, asking the Lord to help him understand. A number of years before this, Jeremiah had given a prophecy. I think it's in the 29th chapter of Jeremiah, in which he told the people of Israel, who were now in captivity in Babylon, that their captivity would be 70 years, and then the Lord was going to work a mighty blessing among them. That 70 years is drawn to a close. And Daniel is very concerned about the prophecy and about Jerusalem. And so he's in prayer. And he had a vision. And we're going to read a good share of that vision today, beginning with verse 5. Verse 5 through verse 14. And in verse 5 it says, "And as I was considering the vision, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes." There's a lot of detail that he puts forth here that is given him in this vision. And it's to help the Jewish people see and understand things that are taking place in their history. And so they will know that God has them in mind. So they will know where they are and what lies ahead of them. And so he saw this he-goat coming from the west. The angel Gabriel told Daniel over in verse 21 that this referred to the king of Greece. So this referred to the king of Greece, the original king of the Greek Empire there in southern Europe. Name was Philip. He had a son named Alexander. He educated Alexander. Alexander was tutored by Aristotle. So he was an educated young man. And he served in his father's army on conquests, and sometimes the battles went well and sometimes the battles went poorly. But when he was just a young man of 25, he assumed the kingship of Greece, Macedonia. And he was thinking and pondering the visions of his father, you know, for conquest and for a great power in the world. I think maybe all the leaders of the nations of the world in those days thought about conquest and growing in power and in fame. And so we're talking here about Greece. And it's said here in this same verse that he came from the west. And of course, Daniel is in Babylon. And so Greece is to the west of Babylon, certainly on the other side of the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus in Europe. And it said, and it seemed as if he touched not the ground. And there is an allusion to the swiftness of what's going to take place. I mean, it's as if this he-goat were running and his feet didn't even touch the ground. He was like he was flying across the space. And so then it says that there came up out of him a notable horn. One big horn right between his eyes. And that horn referred to Alexander. We know him, and we study history, we study about Alexander. We know him as Alexander the Great. Some places he's referred to as Alexander the Magnificent. But greatness for that dream that he had and his skill at carrying out. Verse 6 says, "And he came to the ram that had two horns. And he had beforehand seen a ram standing on the edge of a river, and that ram had two horns. It said, he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and he ran into him in the fury of his power." Verse 20 tells us that ram refers to the Persian, the kings of Persia and Media. Media and Persia is the great power that ruled and dominated the world at that time. They grew to power about 550 BC, and the power of the Babylonian, Persia grew at 550 BC in Babylonia, and then Persia in 330 BC conquered all the Babylonian Empire and even expanded it even further. And this ram that he saw in his vision refers to the kings of Media and Persia. Media, that's an interesting spot. Today, the ancient Media is found and is still a troubled place, and it's found there in the northern portions of Iran and Iraq, and the eastern portion of Turkey. And these Medes that live there are constantly in conquest, in battle, seeking independence and freedom. They want to be a free and independent nation. This is part of the great problem that we're having right now in Iraq. The nation is divided, and they don't know what to do. They're liable to end up making three separate divisions out of the little country of Iraq. And one of those divisions will be given to the Medes. But think about that. People today whose history extends back 2,500 years into the Bible, and we read about them here in the Bible. That's who we're reading about, the Medes and the Persians. Persia of that day is Iran of today. And they had taken over Babylonia, and that is Iraq of today. And so we're reading about the same things that we're reading about in the newspaper. events that are cataclysmic and taking place today. And so we see there's a confrontation here. The goat is charging rapidly at this ram standing beside the edge of the river. And verse 7. Well, I think maybe I'd like to just show you a little overhead right now. First of all, this is the Persian Empire. You can see it there in green. And extends over here on this eastern boundary here is clear into India. And so you can see it's a gigantic power. Here's modern day Iran or Persia. Up in here we have Afghanistan and Kyrgyzstan, and I can't remember the names of all those stands or pronounce them if I did remember them. And it goes clear over here to the Red Sea, and it encompasses to the Persian Gulf, and it encompasses part of Egypt. That was the Persian Empire. That's the ram standing on the edge of the river with two horns. Let's look at the next one. What's that say? Well, that's the Persian Empire. My land. Here I'm just backward. Okay, there's the Persian Empire. Get him off of there. We're going to go back and look at the Greek Empire that was on there to begin with. So excuse me. There's the Greek Empire. Why didn't somebody tell me that? It says that right up there, and I just couldn't read it. So you know, that description that he saw in his vision, it goes right down to detail. Here's where... Is that thing working? Yeah? I can't see it. Here's where Alexander lived, here in Macedonia. And he crossed the Dardanelles right here. Right there. There's a little gap of water that comes right through there. This is the Bosphorus. And then there's a kind of a big sea. And then there's a little gap right there that just wide enough for one big sea-going ship to go up into. And that's where Alexander crossed. He crossed into Asia. And when he got right here, there's a river right there, the River Granicus. And it flows up here into this little inland sea right there. And that's where the Persian general Cyrus was. And he was there with his army, 40,000 men more or less. And Alexander crossed with about 30,000 men, and he soundly defeated the Persian. He defeated him soundly. And then the Persians fled before him. And Alexander... His face confronted with a decision. Shall I follow after this remnants of the Persian army and destroy them? But for some reason or other, he decided not to. And he went southward. And he captured Tyre. And he captured Sidon. And he captured Jerusalem and Israel. And he went on over into Egypt. And he went all over in here. And he captured this and made it part of his empire. And then he came back up. Right up in here, and he met another. Now Cyrus has passed away, and Darius is now the king, and he meets Darius with even a bigger army, 70,000 or 80,000 men, and he still defeated him. He put him to flight, and the armies fled, and he defeated them soundly, and then he came right down the Euphrates River, and he entered into the city of Babylon. When he entered in the city of Babylon, he was received with joy. Strangely, he was received with joy. He had defeated the Persian army. He was received with joy. And he started out again from Babylon with his soldiers. And he took off and he went up in this area. This boundary you hear, that he traveled all that distance. This young man at 26 with 25,000-30,000 men traveled all this distance, conquering as he went along over into India. He came back down here up the Persian coast, and he ended up here in Babylon again. 12 years. That's it. In 12 years, he conquered the whole known world, and my land, how many thousands of miles did he travel? It's almost unbelievable, and I'm sure that all tends to give him the name that he was given of the Great. Verse 7 says, "And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him. He smote the ram and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand." The powerful army in the world of that time, and here a young man of 26, when he got back into Babylon after that conquest of the world, he was 33 years old. No, not quite, 32 years old when he got back there. Just imagine that. 12 years, and he conquered the whole known world. Nothing could stand in front of him. The might of Persia, of the Medes, none of it could stand in front of him. As he went on his journey, he went right up through Media. He went through all of those areas that are so much in the news today. And nobody could stand in front of him. Let's read verse 8. "Therefore, the he-goat waxed very great. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven." So this is talking about this horn is Alexander. He's 32 years old. Just a few days before he turned 33, he'd been drunken. He came back to his home, his apartment, his palace, wherever he was living there. And the next day he died of a fever. 33 years old. Nobody knows what it was exactly that killed him, but some people say it was a drunkenness that killed him. Some people say it was a fever. But at just after 12 years, he had conquered the known world, and then he died. And in the place of this big horn that was broken off, there came up four others in its place. One, in other words, is talking about his kingdom was divided, and it wasn't divided overnight. It took place after several years of fussing and fighting and squabbling and all, but it was divided into four kingdoms. One of them was here. Ptolemy became the ruler of all that was of Egypt and over in the northern coast of Africa. He was a famous ruler. One of the famous Bible cities or cities of biblical scholarship was Alexandria here on the northern coast of Egypt. And that was Ptolemy. And another was over here in Macedonia and near the Dardanelles. This was the king that took care. And then there was one called the King of the North that was here in Syria. And he was the king that affected Israel. The King of the North is the king that affected Israel. And then there was one of the Eastern Empire. I don't know, this part of the empire just seems to have been left by itself. But it was divided into four divisions. Verse 9. An important verse, extremely important verse. "And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land." The pleasant land, that's Israel. Toward the south and toward the east and toward Israel, he grew powerful. This little horn. That's an expression, little horn, in quotation marks. I really expect all of you to recognize, right? Where have we studied about the little horn? Pardon? In Revelation. Well, in Revelations, yes, but it's in the Revelation of Daniel. It's in chapter 7. And it's talking about something completely different than what we're reading here in this. This is the little horn that grew up out of the Roman Empire and became the Antichrist of ancient times, became the power that is identified with the papal power of the Catholic Church. Now, this is a completely different one. Out of one of them, What we read about in chapter 7 of Daniel was a beast with 10 horns, and that was talking about Rome. And in the midst of them came out a little horn. This is completely different. This is talking about four kings that rose up when Alexander died, and out of one of those four kings of Greece came a little horn. And I think that... I think it's important. I'd like to just read a few quotations from some commentators. I read seven commentators as I was studying about the abomination of desolation. I'd like to read a few verses here, or a few words here. One commentator named Barnes that I appreciate greatly said, "This little horn sprang up out of one of the others. It did not spring up in the midst of the others as the little horn of chapter 7 and verse 8 did among the 10 others." Why did he point that out so carefully? He pointed it out so carefully for the reason another commentator goes on to write this: "He's not to be confounded with the little horn of the fourth kingdom, Rome, in chapter 7, verse 8. It is not an independent fifth horn, but it arises out of one of the existing horns. It means a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, to be exact. That's who is meant. None of the previous world rulers had systematically opposed the Jews' religious worship. Hence, the need of prophecy to prepare the Jewish people for this little horn that's coming, Antiochus, that they might be prepared about what is going to happen." And this is what we're reading about. Now, I want you to remember, the Jews are... Turn that off now, would you please? The Jews are now back in Jerusalem. They now have another temple. This is in the silent period of the Bible, between the last book of Malachi and the New Testament. It's those 400 silent years that this is taking place. They're back in Jerusalem, and they have a temple, and they have a temple worship, and they're trying to pattern their worship after the law of Moses. Daniel is living hundreds of years before this time, and yet he's given this vision that these Jewish people would be prepared for what is coming. And the Jewish people did pay great attention to Daniel. And that's why when Jesus was asked by his disciples to tell him about the time of the end, things that were going to take place, and he talked to them, you know, and he mentioned the abomination of desolation. And he was referring, though, to an abomination of desolation that revolved around Rome, when the temple was going to be desecrated and the city cast down and the people destroyed and their religious beliefs destroyed. And he referred to this. But he wasn't referring to what we're reading right now. He was referring to what you're going to read if you study the abomination in chapter 9 and chapter 11 and chapter 12. That's chapter 2, 3, and 4 of this study, and I'm not going to give them. Maybe somebody else will. But that's what he was referring to, the same kind of thing that Daniel was preparing these people for in their day when a Greek ruler named Antiochus ruled that northern part of Asia, of mid-Asia. And so that's the whole preparation. Verse 9, "Out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land." You know, I guess I want to mention a little bit about that little horn again. I got on Google and looked up a couple of things, you know, about the abomination and the word desolation and things. And you can find all kinds of things. But here's a common thought. Here's a common thought out there in the world. This is the most popular thought about these passages that refer to the abomination of desolation. Here's what this author says. You know, number one, Daniel chapter 8, verse 9. That's the verse we just read. Proves that the Antichrist will originate from a very small country. He calls it Lebanon. And he will, chapter 8, verse 9, proves the Antichrist will appear at the same time that his country of origin springs into existence. 8, 9 states the Antichrist will originate somewhere within the geographical area that once comprised the ancient Grecian Empire. And he's going to dominate and rule the Jews, and he's going to be in power for 3.5 years. That's the common thing that's out there today. Well, I read another commentator. I read his book. And you know, and I finally got a little tired of it, and I didn't want to quote any of it, but right here in verse 9, between verse 5 and 9, the Adventist commentators, who I admire greatly, because in all of the Christian world today, there are probably only two groups of people that still believe in ancient prophecy and try to interpret it. And one of the groups is the Adventist. And they try to interpret it correctly. They don't have any idea with this. They don't have anything to do with this Antichrist in the future and the 3.5 years of tribulation that's coming along. They try to account for these things away. But I was very upset with their interpretation. Right here between verse 5 and verse 9, they went from the Greeks there in this great battle that took place, and then all of a sudden in verse 9 they jumped to the Roman Empire, and then they jumped from the open Roman Empire to the Antichrist of the last day, and they used all of the dates that Daniel gives to bring us up to the date of 1844, when their church originated and they had prophesied that Jesus Christ was going to return. And, well, it's just, even though they try to understand and utilize these prophecies, that they do it in a way that puts forth their own point of view rather than looking at what it is really saying and what God's purpose was in giving this prophecy. Verse 11 says, "Yea, he magnified himself." Well, let me go back a little bit. Let me tell you why they'd make that big jump. That I'll just let me see if I can find these verses. First of all, they said the he-goat, it says the he-goat was strong. And then it talked about the horn that came up out of the midst of it, Alexander the Great. And it said he was very strong. And now in verse 9, it says he was exceeding strong. And so they changed from one period of time to another period of time to another period of time, all in the same verse, just because of that little description about how strong he was. Now, verse 11. "Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of hosts. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away. And the place of his sanctuary was cast out." We're talking about Antiochus of Greece, who was in power about 170 B.C. This is the time frame. And it says that he, by him, the daily sacrifice will be taken away and the sanctuary cast down. And so this is what Daniel is trying to prepare the Jewish people for. Something is going to happen to the sanctuary. One of the commentators writes this, what that means. God Himself, the Lord of the Sabbath, the host of heaven and earth, stars and angels and earthly ministers, shall be taken down in esteem among the Jewish people by this Antiochus. And if we go back and look at what happened in Israel during that time, many of the Jewish people actually lost their complete faith in their religion, and they accepted the teachings of the Greeks. They accepted the education of the Greeks. You know, they accepted the language of the Greeks. The entire New Testament was written in the Greek language. They accepted and bought this deception that Antiochus brought to them. It says, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. Antiochus, the king, actually came into Israel. You know, he had a sorrowful plans to conquer the king of the south. He went against the king of the south in Ptolemy down in Egypt, and he was defeated. Now he was angry and he was upset. I mean, you know, that happens in our lives today. We get angry and upset, and then we go home. We get angry and upset, and we're at work. And then we go home, and one of our children or our wife says something to us, and we lash out at them, you know. And that's what this man did, only he had power over peoples and over nations. He was upset because he was frustrated in his dire desire to defeat the Egyptians and take it into his reign. And he went back up through Israel, murmuring and muttering against the Jews, and he was going to destroy them. And he it is that took away the daily sacrifice and cast down the sanctuary. It said, first of all, well, I'll read verse 12. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. Because of the transgression of the Jewish people, this terrible thing was going to befall. Isaiah talked about that. I'm going over and read a verse or two in Isaiah. I'm going to look at Isaiah 59. Prophesying to Jerusalem. I'm going to read verse 14. Well, I think I'll read verses 12, 13, and 14. For our transgressions are multiplied before thee, and our sins testify against us. For our transgressions are with us, and as for our iniquities, we know them, in transgressing and lying against the Lord, and departing from our God, speaking oppression and revolt, conceiving, uttering the heart from the heart words of falsehood, and judgment is turned backward, and justice stands afar off, for truth is fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter. That's what Daniel was referring to in his prophecy, that this, he says, that this host was given him against the daily sacrifice because of the transgression of the Jewish people. And it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced, and it prospered, almost identifying with Isaiah's words there. And one of the commentators says that Antiochus came into the temple. He took out all of the golden temple vessels that they had there for their sacrifices and for their offerings and their worship. He took them out, and he accepted them for his own. And he installed in the temple an image of Jupiter, and he wanted the Jewish people to worship this image of Jupiter that was now in the temple. And then he came back in 2 years, and he burned down the whole city of Jerusalem. And so these things actually took place, and they happened. Verse 13, then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, oh, now, he hears one saint speaking and asking a question, and then the other one answered, but not to the one who answered the question. He's answering to Daniel. How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? How long is it going to be? How long is this desecration of the temple going to be? Antiochus came into Israel and he came into Jerusalem and he forbid them to give their to use their sacrifices anymore. Under the Mosaic law, every morning and every evening, a sacrifice was presented. And he took those away and he forbid them to give those sacrifices. And he demanded that they worship this image of Jupiter that he had placed in the temple. And this is the abomination and the desolation that is being spoken of here. Verse 14, and he said unto me, this is the interesting thing. You know, it was saints who were talking, but when the answer comes, it was given to Daniel. He said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Well, I was kind of amazed because almost always Daniel uses that year-to-day principle when he is using the times like that. But in this instance, he's actually going to convert it into 2,300 days. And one of the commentators gives us a good reasoning for why that he would do that. But one of the commentators goes into great elaborate detail now about all the things that Antiochus had done as he entered into Jerusalem and as he expressed his wrath toward the Jewish people and toward the high priest and all of the things he did in forbidding the worship there. And then he states, these things began on August of 171 B.C. And they continued until the Maccabees rose up in a revolution. And you know, we don't have in our scriptures, we don't have their writings. But there are two books in the Apocrypha, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, that describe historically many of these events that we are reading about in prophecy. And those that happened in about this same time, just a couple hundred years before the Christian era. Said they continued until Judas Maccabees brought it to an end and cleansed and rededicated the temple on December 25th, 165 B.C. That's the date. It would be 6 years and 110 days. And when we look at those dates there, we find that that's the amount of time that it was forbidden to have the daily sacrifice. And when it was restored again by this revolution of the Maccabees, when they defeated Antiochus and they threw out the Greeks and they established their worship, their Jewish worship in the temple again. 6 years and 110 days. Then it says, and then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Maccabees writes, and you can read it in 2 Maccabees chapter 10, verse 5. I looked it up and it said, the sanctuary was purified on the 25th of Kislev, the same day of the same month as that on which the foreigners had profaned it. The joyful celebration lasted for 8 days. That celebration, we can read about that celebration in the words of in the New Testament. In St. John, I'm just going to read a verse here in St. John chapter 10, verse 22 says, and it was at Jerusalem, the feast of dedication, and it was winter. That's this feast. On the 25th of December, they have an 8-day celebration called the Feast of Dedication, is when Maccabees cleansed the temple, removed all of the profane things that the Greeks had placed in it, and restored the worship, the Jewish worship, once again in Jerusalem. That one of the commentators, I think, gives a pretty good reason of why Daniel went into so much more intricate detail that related to specific instances and times than we find in New Testament revelations and prophecies. And this one commentator said, it's because unlike the Christians who believe in immortality, the Jewish people could only be assured and find peace with things that they were going to see here in this life. Because they didn't have that belief in immortality and generations and generations passing, and it doesn't bother us because we see the grander scheme of things. Here Daniel was interested in when that sanctuary was going to be cleansed. It was going to be 300 years from the time Daniel lived and gave the prophecy. And yet he was reassured that God's will would be done. The temple would be cleansed, and once again the daily sacrifice would be offered. I'd like to read verse 17. Speaking of the angel Gabriel, say, and he, the angel Gabriel, came near where I stood. And when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. At the time of the end shall be the vision. What he's saying here is this vision is going to be fulfilled, and when it is fulfilled, you will understand the vision. Or by the vision, when these things take place, you will see them and recognize them. Oh, if that were only true. If that were only true, that when we see things, we read things in prophecy, and when we see them happen, we would recognize them. How wonderful it would have been if the church, back in 1955 and 1956 and 7, knowing this prophecy in 3 Nephi chapter 9 about the carrying of this book and the restored gospel back to the descendants of the American Indians would be, usher in and be a sign for the reestablishment of the Jewish people in Israel. And we could have proclaimed, you know, very shortly we're going to see is Jerusalem liberated by the Jewish people once again. Impossible for people to believe, you know. But when we did see it, then we recognized the meaning. We recognized surely the meaning of the vision. But oh, if when we read the vision and the prophecy, we could just be that sure of its fulfillment. You know, I kind of like something that a verse in Ether here along that line. We have difficult things in these prophecies back here in the book of Revelation. Difficult to understand, and most people in the world don't even make an effort. Like the brothers there in Africa. And no doubt in other places as well, when we teach them about Revelation and what some of these things mean and how they apply to our world and our religion today. They say, nobody ever told us that before. We've asked and asked and asked, and all of our ministers just said, oh, that doesn't make any difference to anybody, and they just drop it. Oh, if we could just have a really good understanding of what these things. In the book of Ether, there's a little verse here I like to see. And then shall my revelations, which I have caused to be written by my servant John, that's the book of Revelation, be unfolded in the eyes of all the people. Well, let us be alert. Let us be aware. Let us endeavor to know what are those things that John the Revelator has given for the future. Sure, they're for the future, but when they're unfolded, they'll unfold in the eyes of all the people. You know, the Book of Mormon tells us over and over again, this is a choice land, and it'll be protected by God as long as we serve the God of this land, who is Jesus Christ. There will be no foreign kings be able to come and establish any dominion here. And so we were shocked, you know. I was shocked to the core When I'm sitting there in Honduras and watching 9/11 take place, something that had never happened in our history before, it makes me apprehensive, you know, that there's a prophecy there. God's hand will be over us and protecting us as long as we are obeying and be obedient to Jesus Christ. What caused this great desolation, that's caused the abomination of desolation to fall upon the temple and the city of Jerusalem and the holy people? Their transgressions, their ignorance of prophecy, their refusal to listen to the prophets. How important it is that we pay attention to that. And verse 19 says, "And he said, Gabriel again, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last time of the indignation. For at the time appointed, the end shall be." It is fixed. These prophecies that are found in the Holy Scripture, they are fixed in time. God has a calendar and a great plan that encompasses the nations of the world, and those prophecies are fixed in time. They will be accomplished according to the time of the Lord. And we need to be in tune with that we might understand. Well, once again, thank you for the difficulty in following and paying attention to this, but these things are, they really can affect us one way or another. They can strengthen our faith, or we can just be ignorant of what is going on and what has gone on in the past and what God's plan is for His people. So the Lord bless you.